This season at the First Time Podcast, we are returning to our first time roots. We hear all the time from listeners who've gone from thinking about writing a book to starting to write a book to having their very own debut author experience.
One of the things that these new authors say is that they've gone back and listened to all the episodes that cover off the various milestones. So this year we're going back too. We want to capture that first time again ourselves. We're going to follow a first-time author across the year, catching up multiple times along the way.
Our very first follower first-timer is Megan Rogers, author of The Heart is a Star. This segment of Follower First-Timer is brought to you by HarperCollins. Megan Rogers began her working life as an editorial assistant at Allen & Unwin before moving to the State Library of Victoria in marketing. In 2014, Megan finished a PhD in creative writing at RMIT, which resulted in the book Finding the Plot, A Maternal Approach to Madness in Literature, published by feminist publisher Demeter Press. She also has a Bachelor of Arts Science, a Diploma of Professional Writing and Editing, a Graduate Diploma in Professional Communication, and a Master's of Marketing. Megan lives on the Mornington Peninsula outside of Melbourne. Welcome, Megan, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Now, as you may or may not know, in this podcast, we always start at the very beginning. You are our first follower, first-time author, and it will be no different. So tell us, have you always been a writer?
Yes, I think that I sound very cliche when I answer this question because I am, you know, I was one of those little girls who wanted this from about the age of four, and I still have it actually in the next room, but I have copies of very 1970s Herb books that my mum used to have in Hurstbridge, and I used to write all the way through them because I felt it looked more like a real book than, say, stapling pieces of paper together. And then I used to put them on the bookshelf and pretend that I'd written these books. I think I may have even tried to sell them once or twice. I don't think I had many friends. But, yeah, I really genuinely wanted this from the earliest time I can remember, all the way through my childhood into my teens and 20s and 30s, and it is really such a surreal and joyous thing that it is finally coming to life.
I have to ask, what stories did you write in those books? And also, I want you to go and find one and show it to us, please, because I feel like that is necessary. So tell us
first.
Yes, please. Go and get it, and then you can tell us about it. Oh, my goodness. Megan Rogers, can you please show us one of your earliest storybooks?
Really? It's about herbs. I was thinking maybe that was like a shorthand for something else, no, but it is literally a book on herbs.
Very 1970s. But you can see it's probably a little bit hard to.
Oh my gosh, I love this so much.
A very loved book.
This is when I was really young. This is when I was about four.
Writing your first novel.
This is my first novel. I'm not sure whether Catherine Milne would be very interested in it, but you can kind of, it's hard to see the grey lead, but I've got different things written and scribbled all the way through. It's falling apart a bit now.
It is so precious.
It's very, very loved. Hopefully one day they are auctioning that off.
Yeah, absolutely. Megan Rogers, first novel, written in 1970 Herbs.
Yep.
So, Megan, aside from the Herb book, do you remember the first thing that you had published?
Yes. So I was in grade five and at Parkdale Primary School, and I entered, there was a local policeman who was retiring, and they called for students to write a short story about him, even though I didn't know him, to enter into competition, then it would be published in the local newspaper.
And he must have been a fairly well-known policeman, like a locally.
With all due respect, and to be fair, I'm not sure he was. but it was the opportunity to enter a short story competition, so I went for it. I'd never done anything like that before or even considered doing anything like that before, and I didn't tell anyone I was doing it because I was so scared. And I'm quite an introvert, and I was quite introverted at primary school. And so I just sat in my bedroom as I spent most of those years writing. And I wrote a story about a policeman who woke up and he thought that he had all these pimples all over his face. He was very embarrassed because he had to do a press conference and speak to the public, and he was really nervous, and it was all about his vulnerabilities as a man and a character and where that came from and his childhood. And then the twist at the end was that he woke up and it was all a dream and he had chicken pox.
Oh. The classic end to a children's story, isn't it? It
was so he had spots all over his face, but just in a different way. That was it. And it was such a wonderful experience because I did end up winning that local prize. Not very prestigious, I know, but they gave me, the best part about it was they gave me book vouchers for prizes.
Oh.
And so, you know, we didn't have very much growing up. And so to have not a blank check per se, but quite a bit of money in those days to spend at my local bookshop. And I think that I sent the people who worked in that bookshop, bless them, quite crazy, because I spent hours choosing wanting to really make the most of this opportunity that probably wouldn't come again anytime soon.
How many copies of that newspaper do you still have, or did you purchase at the time or collect?
I have about four or five lying around. I think they are actually in one of those, you know, those boxes you buy from the $2 shops that you put things in for your kids. I think it's in one of those in the cupboard somewhere. So
adding to the Megan Rogers auction.
Yeah, that's right.
Not sure whether you'd get much money, but
So Megan, we flash forward a few years from those fateful days to the present day. Right now you're on the cusp of having your first novel being released. It's often easy to look back and connect the dots and see how one thing led to another. Aside from winning that short story competition about the police officer that may not have been famous, what have been some of the big writing moments and experiences along the way?
That's a really good question. And I think when you go along this journey, part of the process is solidifying those moments and crystallizing them. And in many ways, this process is as much about psychoanalysis, analyzing yourself, as it is about getting a book published. So I think one of the biggest moments for me was in high school. I had one of those amazing teachers. I had a literature teacher called Mrs. Chanderhill, and she was phenomenal. And she sent in a poem that I'd written to the Melbourne Writers Festival, and they were doing a publication that published students' work. And I had written a poem, and unbeknownst to me, she sent it in. And it ended up getting chosen for publication, which I am forever grateful for. And she told me that there was going to be a little event where you went up and you shook hands and things like that. And I lived in Frankston at the time, and to get up there by myself was just a bit too hard basket for me at the time. And I was a bit overwhelmed by it all. And she ended up finding out that I wasn't brave enough to go. And she met me at the gate at school. She threw me in her Valiant car and she said, "Get in, we're going up, I'm taking you up." So she drove me up to the Melbourne Writers Festival, went back when it was at the Malt House, which I adored. And it was my first experience ever of anything like that. And we went into one of the little rooms there, and they had the other writers there. And we got presented with a book, and it was the first time that I'd ever seen my writing in print. And I was very emotional and overwhelmed. And then we went down to the cafe and we had lunch. And I was very shy and I didn't bring any money with me or anything like that. And the canteen lady said, "You know, what would you like?" Kind of little girl, because I looked quite young for my age too. I was 16 at the time, I think. And I was thinking, you know, ham and cheese toastie. And she said, "We've got some children's boxes if you'd like." And my literature teacher, in pure Mrs. Chanderhill style, said, "Excuse me, this young lady is a writer at this festival and she will have the smoked salmon salad and a pot of tea." And it was the first time I had certainly had smoked salmon. And I still remember sitting outside in the courtyard on a wrought iron table and chair, eating with Mrs. Chanahill this smoked salmon salad. I can remember how it tasted. I can remember the sounds and the smells, and I can remember feeling for the first time as if, you know, I think like many of us, I grew up thinking, you know, maybe there's something a bit wrong with me, or I'm not quite right, or I'm a bit different. And it was the first time that I sat there and I thought, you know, maybe I am meant to do this, and just maybe I might have a little inkling within me that means that I can one day get a novel published.
Oh, that's such a lovely story.
Where is Mrs. Chanahill now?
Okay, sorry. I have another story. So I hadn't seen her in many, many years, and I put the call out on Facebook, as all good things are done, to my Facebook community, and I said, I'm looking for Mrs. Chanahill. I went to a school called John Paul College on the Mornington Peninsula, and I graduated in 97. So I had all that cohort looking for me, and somebody ended up messaging me with her mobile. And I called her a few weeks ago, and my hands, I was more nervous making that call than I have been about many things over the past few years. My hands were shaking, my hands are shaking now. And I said, hello, Mrs. Chanahill, this is Megan. And my maiden name was Megan Brown. So I said, it's Megan Brown. I'm not sure if you remember me. And she said, oh, Megan, don't introduce yourself, dear. I remember you like it was yesterday. And and she just was so beautiful and wonderful and so just like she was. You know, it was like I was 16 all over again, and she was my teacher, and it puts you right back there being a little girl with your mentor or your idol with you. And so next week we're catching up for coffee.
Oh.
And I'm actually going to give, you know, back in the day she wrote me a Christmas card at the end of year 12. And it said something along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing, you will do this one day. You've just got to keep the faith. And it's a little tiny little Christmas card. And I kept that in a box, probably with the newspaper short story. And I'm going to bring that along and show her that, and to tell her, because I used to, when I was writing the novel, I used to keep it in front of me. And that was, I'm 43 now, so that was a long time ago. And it just reminds me the impact that people like teachers can have.
Well, I'm nearly crying. So that was a great story, but also reminding me, and will be the same for you, Catherine, I'm sure, how many times writers tell us that the significant moment, or the moment that they realized that maybe they had it in them, was with a primary school or a high school teacher, and they can remember the name of that teacher, and they can remember exactly the feeling of the moment that they said they knew that they could do it. So I love that. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Pleasure.
I know, I feel like I want to end there. However, we do also want to talk about the book that's coming out, The Heart is a Star. Megan, when did you know that you wanted to write this story, and how did you begin?
So that is a great question. That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? These are the origin stories that we, I think they become as mythologized as anything, don't they? But so this is, I guess, the first time that I'm telling this story. So I'll do
good
the best
practice.
So my youngest was about 6 weeks old, and I had a 2.5-year-old. And one night, my baby, Maya, she wasn't breathing properly. She had that Strider cough and breath that is terrifying, and she was turning blue. And so I raced her to the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. My husband was in Sydney at the time, and so I bundled my 2.5-year-old, hard to get a toddler out at that time of night, into the car, into the hospital, and she had pretty bad bronchiolitis, or bad croup, and she wasn't really okay. And they rushed her up, and they were incredible and competent and kind. And they really saved, or felt like they saved her life to me as a mum. And we were there for a couple of nights. And then I was sitting in the cafeteria, just about to go home when they discharge you, really not ready to go home. I hadn't slept, and I didn't want to go home to an empty house and figure it all out by myself. And I was sitting there breastfeeding and probably staring into space, and a woman approached me, and she had lanyards on and so forth, so I knew that she was somewhat professional. And she said, would you like me to hold your baby for a moment and sit here whilst you go to the bathroom and get something to eat? And usually I'm very, very bad at accepting help, but I was too tired and exhausted to pretend as if that wasn't the best thing anyone had ever said to me in that moment. And so I very graciously accepted and I went to the bathroom and I think I had the best ham and cheese sandwich I've ever had in my life and a cup of tea, and I sat back down and I just said, thank you so much for offering to do that, because I was feeling really lonely and confused. And she, as strangers often do, opened up to me herself. She said that she was an anaesthetist at the Royal Children's, that she had two growing children and often felt as if she wasn't doing anything particularly well. She didn't feel like she was being a good mom or a good doctor, a good wife or a good daughter or any of those things. She just started looking after her mum as well. And we bonded on that because as I was sitting there, I was getting phone calls from nursing homes because we were trying to get my father, who had developed Alzheimer's during that time, into a home. And those things don't turn off. You know, you have to pick up the phone and you have to deal with it. So it's those sandwich years when you've got children and parents and so forth. And she said to me, you know, one of the greatest gifts of this job is that it's taught me not to look away, that when I see someone, when I see pain, when I see grief, when I see confusion, when I see loneliness, I try never to look away. And so I went home that night and I wrote the opening line, which never changed, which is like a splinter in my finger. I always thought that if I left my mother alone, she would work herself out. And I wanted to write a story about a woman during which I never looked away, that I represented her lived experience and the story that came to me. I don't write autobiographically because I like to write as I read. I like to uncover the story and meet the characters. And I wanted to do that all the while not looking away, not censoring her or trying to make her the kind of woman who would be liked by everyone. I just wanted to represent her life in a really realistic way, to honour what that anaesthetist had said to me. And at the time, I was also having friends who were, you know, getting divorced or finding new relationships or losing jobs. They were becoming mums or not being able to become mums, and lots of other things, all journeys and paths which changed not only the view of their view of themselves, but their identities, which they'd established over the first quarter or half of their lives. And I wanted to write something which honoured those liminal and in-between times when we can feel so lost and lonely and confused that it can seem as though there is absolutely no way out. And I wanted to do that whilst not looking away.
Well, I can say, Megan Rogers, as I imagine Catherine and I are your, you know, target market, really, as middle-aged women in the liminal years. You just...
Can we not say middle-aged?
Sorry, I know. My friend Mel's middle-aged all that? The time. Because I take that back. Phoebe, cut that. you just nailed that. That story.
Oh, my God. I feel like I've nearly cried three times in this interview. I know. Already. Like, if you can tell the story on the page as well as you tell the story in real life.
It's the dream.
Jesus Christ. Well, you must be able to. I mean, that's not obvious. Oh,
but also because this is, you know, because we want this to be for our listeners something that is quite transparent and that they are seeing the workings of as well, yeah. What you're going through at the moment is this working out of the narrative of who you, Megan Rogers, are as author, and the narrative that we also always talk about, this idea that the writing of the book has its own narrative and it forms as you go through the kind of process. And already three incredible anecdotes about your origin story. So for listeners, writers who are listening, watch how Megan does it, because she's nailing it already.
That's very kind of you.
I have chills. Yeah. Megan, we are so excited to follow you this year. This is just the beginning. We are going to talk to you multiple times across the course of this debut year to see how it does unfold. It would be, or the plan is now, to kind of capture how you're feeling. So can you tell us, how are you feeling now? What are you most excited about?
I wake up every day with a bubbly, excited anticipation that makes me feel like I'm that four-year-old girl writing in her books, but now I've sold one.
Yes.
And you know what it also is? It's not just bubbly excitement, if I'm completely honest. There is an element of relief because this isn't, as I've said by my journey story, this isn't a new dream for me. And, you know, I think it, especially because I wrote a lot of the novel over lockdown and it was incredibly difficult. And I think there were many times when I was kind of, to be honest, on my knees, thinking, I don't know if I can do this. And in my mind, even though it's not real, the way that we, you know, get things in our head, I had gotten into my head that this is kind of my last chance. And even though I'd never sent a novel out before, you know, I'd written over the years, I did all the courses, you know, I had the well-worn Victorian path of creative writing. And, you know, I have children and I have bills to pay and I have these realities which don't go away. And so when I wake up with that bubbly anticipation, there is also a deep sense of relief that all that hard work and the multiple times, because I think, you know, it's that kind of, you know, gestalt psychology or gestalt psychology where the finished product equals more than the sum of its parts. Mm. And when you look at a novel, like when I look at my daughter's a swimmer and when I watch her, she's a competitive swimmer, God knows how, because I can't swim to save myself, but she glides through that water and it looks effortless and she loves it and it's joyful. I can look at that and see all the choices and the years and the struggles and the hard work and pushing through pain that have gone into that. And much the same, you know, when you pick up a novel, it looks like a novel and we have this myth that we think people kind of get up and write a book. But as we all know, there are years of daily choices and it's a daily exercise of choosing to write. You're not going to a party. You're not doing this. You're not watching TV. You choose to write over and over and over again. And so how I'm feeling is there is an element of relief that all of those choices, the accumulation of those choices on a daily basis, the times which I thought I was being a bad mum or a bad wife or a bad daughter or a bad friend by choosing writing, that now I have something that I can at least hold to my heart and say it was worth it.
I love that. I don't think anyone has mentioned relief before, but it's a really valid and I think a really prevalent emotion. I can really relate to that. In addition to excitement, in addition to relief, is there anything that you're feeling anxious about?
Do we have like 2 hours? yes, many. One of the things I think that you come face to face with during this process is what you're terrified about. And a lot of writers do talk about fear, and I know that. But for me, fear, and to get this book written, I actually had to really befriend my fear, because for many, many years, the reason why I hadn't sent any writing away and I think why I hadn't finished a novel was because I was so scared that people would say no, as we all are. I was scared that I wouldn't be good enough. I was scared that this dream that I'd had since I was 4 years old, you know, like in Australian Idol, you know, where you see the singers sing and the judges go, actually, can't actually sing, even though your mum has told you that you can. I was worried I would be that girl. So my fears, I learned, were actually not bad. And I had spent many years berating myself and saying, don't feel that way. That's silly. That's stupid. That's just holding you back. And hearing all those cliches about, you know, just ignore it or feel the fear and do it anyway, or things like that. And I realized through this process and through writing the book that actually my fears are the little girl inside of me. And every time I point my finger at that fear and I berate that fear, I'm really berating that little girl in me. And the shame that I feel that I've developed over the years. And it wasn't until I started talking to those anxieties and fears the way that I would to my children or to a child that I started to be able to hold her hand and walk forward. So I had to kind of say, look, I know you are really anxious and scared about this, but you know what? We can, you know, we can do really hard things and we're going to do this together, and you're going to be terrified, but I'm here for you and it's okay. And you're going to feel really scared, and it's not a bad thing. It's really understandable. And especially because of various things that have happened to you and over the years, it makes a lot of sense. And so my anxieties and fears, to answer your question, are very similar ones to little girls have, I guess, if I'm honest and vulnerable about it. They are about someone calling me up and saying, actually, we've realised that you really actually suck. And it took us a while to figure it out, but apparently you do. So contract ripped up. Sorry, no book. And that's the anxiety. And then I guess once the book's out, the anxiety is that, you know, of course people will read it and none of this is new or unspoken about, I'm sure, that, you know, people will say things about it which shine a light upon that fear and reinforce it, which is, yeah, actually you suck. And so every time I feel that way, I need to be kind to that fear and that anxiety, rather than what I did for very many, many, many years is be quite cruel and unkind. And so I'm trying to practice kind of radical kindness and acceptance to that little girl in me who is quite voraciously at the moment expressing a lot of concern about the next year. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds so tough on ourselves, aren't we?
So tough, but also like a deeply wise and insightful and gentle place to have come to with yourself at this point, you know, to go in and not be having to do that decision-making or thinking or therapy, you know, after the book already comes out. Like that seems very, very wise that you have reached that already, Megan. Well done.
Megan, what feels pressing right now? You're at the beginning. Is there anything that it feels like you must do?
Oh, that's a great question. So I'm doing the final proofread of the book. And this is, interestingly, I mean, I'm a writer who loves writing. I love the craft. Every book I read is about writing. I can't get enough of it. One of the greatest joys is not just, you know, getting the modern day version of my her book out in the world, but it is being able to talk to writers about writing and to readers about reading. And that has always been my greatest love. And so I guess one of the most pressing things for me is to make sure I enjoy it and to come back to the anxieties and the fears that are there, to continuously remind myself that this is the moment right now to feel incredibly grateful, incredibly happy, and the joy of it all, rather than letting those fears become overpowering to that joy. And so as I edit, which I love doing, I try to often sit there and, you know, this is what I love, reading the words, playing with words. You know, I spoke to my in-house editor, my managing editor, the other day for about half an hour about what we were going to italicize. And I could talk about that for hours. Is it going to be internal dialogue? Is it going to be this? And having those conversations about the craft is endlessly joyous to me. And so I guess the most pressing thing for me at the moment is to make sure that every time, you know, much like actually the decision to keep coming back to the writing, it's always a distraction, isn't it? It's always trying to be mindful enough to beat the distraction. So, you know, do I need to do the laundry? Do I need to, you know, think about how I'm going to plan a birthday party? No, I'm going to choose to write. And much the same, it's, am I going to give myself the worst case scenario and make sure that I've got complete control over that situation? Or am I going to choose joy and choose to be happy and grateful and present in this moment? And so for me, much like writing was a daily choice, the joy and the happiness in the moment is, it's a choice, and I want to make sure that I make it.
Mm. I always think of that Dylan Alcott, the tennis player.
I was actually just going to say that because I heard you make that It's so funny. I actually said that this morning to a friend of mine, and I heard you say that because, of course, I've listened to every one of your podcasts. And I heard you say that quote, and I'll let you say
it. The quote is for listeners, is fuck it, how good is this? Mm. Which I he has two. He has that, and then he has just be me, which I think of so often. I think they're such useful things, because that four-year-old girl would look at you now and be so, so excited.
That's right. And in many, it's interesting you say that, because I had a quote on, you know, everyone has quotes on the computer as they're writing. But one of my quotes was, you know, once upon a time, you were a little girl who wanted this, don't give up on her. And I never wanted to give up on her, because all those fears about not being enough and having someone call up and say, actually, you really suck, that would be me giving up on her.
It is, no one has ever done that. We all know that.
Yes. Right? That
like this fear that we all have. Yeah. Megan, this is the beginning. We are going to catch up again multiple times across the year. In the meantime, where can our listeners find you?
So you can find me on Instagram at Megan Rogers Writer. There's underscores there. So Megan underscore Riders, Rogers underscore Rider. That's kind of where I, you know, post a lot of stuff and share silly Christmas tree anecdotes.
Not silly, not silly.
That's I guess the main space that that I utilize. I find it really hard to use lots of different platforms. I'm terrible at Twitter, terrible at TikTok.
It's dying anyway.
Twitter's going to implode.
For whatever reason, that's my poison of choice. And so people can find me there. And it's so incredibly wonderful to start getting people reach out and to talk to me. And I love it. And just for anyone listening, you know, for some reason people keep messaging me and saying, I'm not a stalker. I didn't want to reach out to you. I'm really sorry. I would love you to reach out. It is the highlight of my day when I get messages and when I talk to people. I get messages from, you know, people who are experiencing a lot of anxieties about their writing process. I'm always happy and very available to write back. So please don't ever think that, you know, you're a hindrance or that I think you're a stalker, because it would bring me a lot of joy for you to reach out, and please do if you want to.
And Megan won't say this yet, but we will teach her to say it as we go along. You can pre-order The Heart is a Star, and we will put that link in our show notes as well, because I, for one, am terribly excited about getting this book into my brain. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.